Amos Fortune, Free Man, Chapter 10, Evergreen Years, 1794 to 1801. The years went on in a quiet way. Violet and Celindia spun and wove, and their lines were as much in demand as Amos's leathers. Often a man coming from a long distance to leave a hide would not go home empty-handed. Seeing the fine linens that were woven in the tanner's house, he would secure one or more to take home to his wife. It was good that the loom could be so useful, for Amos had begun to feel the fullness of his years. An ox hide was more than he could handle alone, and even the daily tramping of the ooze tired him. But he still carried his head high, and there was strength in his arms and light in his eyes. Another apprentice had been added to the Fortune household, a white boy, young Charlie Toothacker, one of seven children of Roger and Mary Toothacker in Luxembourg. In nearby Massachusetts. Amos had known the boy's father in the Woburn days, for Dr. Toothacker had lived in nearby Bellerica, and he had always been a good friend to the Negroes. He had tended both Lily and Lydia in their last illnesses and would never accept any payment from Amos. But now this man, whose father and grandfather before him had been doctors, had written the Jaffrey Tanner that things had gone hard with him, and that he was being warned out of Lunenburg. He wanted to place his children in homes where they would have good care, and what meant more, the influence of a good example. So he had asked Amos if he would take Charles during the years of his minority. Amos had been happy to be able to do something for the kind-hearted doctor. Indenture papers were drawn up, witnessed, and exchanged, and Charles Toothacker, 19 years old, became a part of the Fortune family. He's a gentleman born, and he's got it in him to be a doctor like his father when he's grown, Amos said to Violet. But to learn a trade is a good way as any to start in life. Amos often took the indenture paper from the drawer when he kept his receipts and read it through, wanting to assure himself that he was doing all he had agreed to do for the son of his old friend. He read aloud to himself. This indenture witnesseth that Roger Toothacre of Lunenburg in the county of Worcester in Commonwealth of Massachusetts physician hath put and doth by these presents voluntarily and of his own free will and accord put and bind his son Charles Toothacre, an apprentice to Amos Fortune of Jaffrey, in the county of Cheshire, in the state of New Hampshire, tanner, to learn his art, trade, or mystery, after the manner of an apprentice, to serve him from the day of the date hereof, for and during the term, of until he shall arrive at the age of 21 years. During all which term, the said apprentice has said master faithfully shall serve, his secrets keep, his lawful commands gladly everywhere obey. He shall do no damage to his master, nor see it to be done by others, without letting or giving notice thereof to his said master. He shall not waste his said master's goods, nor lend them unlawfully to any. He shall not commit fornication, nor contract matrimony within the said term. At cards and dice, or any unlawful games, he shall not play, whereby his said master may have damage with his own goods, nor the goods of others. He shall not absent himself day nor night from his master's service without his leave, nor haunt alehouses, taverns, nor playhouses, but in all things behave himself as a faithful apprentice ought to do during said term. And the said master shall use the utmost of his endeavors to teach or cause to be taught or instructed the said apprentice in the trade or mystery he now followeth, and procedure and procure and provide for him sufficient meat, drink, apparel, lodging, and washing, fitting for such an apprentice during the said term, and at the end of said to procure and provide for said apprentice, and to learn him, if he is capable of learning, to read, write, cipher fitting for such an apprentice, and for the true performance of all and every the said covenants and agreements either of the said parties bind themselves unto the other by these presents, in witness whereof they have interchangeably put their hands and seals this 11th day of March in the year of our Lord 1793, signed, sealed, and delivered in presence of us, Roger Toothacker, Charles Toothaker, William Turner, Jane Turner. Amos tilted his head toward Violet as he folded the paper and put it away. There are things Charlie would rather do than learn to read and write and cipher, but we'll make a good tanner of him first, and that will give us a foundation to build on. He'll learn more than tanning when you've taught him all you know, Violet replied. He'll learn what it is to be a free man. Since the day Amos had begun to live in freedom, his life had been a series of curious accomplishments, known in their richness and wonder only to him. Lily, Lydia, Violet, and Celindia, they stood there like milestones along his way, and behind them all was Athmun. Amos held her always in the tender loveliness of her 12 years, and because of her need to be cared for and his longing for her to be cherished, he had dedicated himself to helpless folk. It was Athmun who had been the fount of freedom to those others. Amos thought, as he reached back into memory of his beloved sister, he had acted for her, and so he would account to her when they met together at the Jordan. Evening after evening, as he sat out in front of his house, listening to the clack of the loom, listening to the Berdew boy beating the hides, he thought of his meeting with Athmun. When sunset wove a pattern of color in the west, he would often walk up to the small hill that gave him a wide view of the mountain. Monad Nock, towering splendidly against the ebbing day. Letting his vision hold it, he felt happy, for he was still climbing it, though his feet had not been on its slope since he had turned 90. It was during the summer of 1801 that Amos Fortune began to feel he was drawing near the end of the road, but there was something more he wanted to do before he left Jaffrey. "You won't mind waiting, will you, Lord? Know what it is I want to do, and you know it's a good thing for your children, but you haven't yet shown me how to do it." His mind traveled far back to the memory these days, and there were times when the past seemed as real as the present. As a good workman, he had won the respect of his townspeople and of many who came to deal with him from miles around. As a member of another race, he was given such place as the white people thought he should occupy. No matter how devotedly he loved the church or how faithfully he served it, he could call no pew his own, but must sit with his family in the cold north gallery in the place reserved for Negroes. Accepted in a communion, as he had been, he must still dwell on the fringe, though his heart was at the core. A lifetime had accustomed him to such an attitude, but it could not keep him from wanting something worthier for his people. Violet had no place for sure respect and dignity save in the home he had built for her, though people came from far to buy her linens and give them honored places in their homes. And even Celindia was not always free from taunting and abuse. Amos felt he could bear affronts himself, but what was the meaning of a man's life if it did not make the way better for those that came after him? His own back bore the scar the lash had made on him as it broke the skin and branded him forever, not as a renegade, but as an object upon which the white man might exercise his power. It was only a year ago he recalled that he had taken a hide for delivery to the tavern. He would not have chosen such a place for delivery had the owner not specified it, and when he got there, he would have turned away if he could, for the man was not in such a state as one with whom he liked to do business. Amos Fortune had stood in the doorway, and the owner of the hide had called to him from the bar. "What do I owe you?" he had asked. Amos answered, $5, proud to be giving his price to the new tender. "Putting on airs," he said. The man laughed back. "A pound sterling is what I'd call it." Amos stood tall and straight on the threshold, facing a room full of men, all strangers to him, save Alexander Milliken. "It's your leather, but it's my price," he said quietly, "and we've each got a right to our own." The man guffawed loudly and lunged across the room to seize the leather. Amos was tempted to hold on to it until he received his money, but feeling the man's strength, he let the leather go. He was one against a room full, for Milliken was not the man to take sides against any of his customers. Amos said, $5 is the price you agreed to when you brought the hide to me. The man laughed again and tossed a handful of coins on the floor. Money has lost its value since then. Take what you can get and be glad of it. Amos was obligated to get down on his knees to pick up the coins that had rolled all over the room. A fire was burning in him, and he trudged home with the pittance in his pocket and no redress at hand. For when a white man chose to be overruling, there was little the black man could say or do. But Amos would not go home while hate burned within him. So he sat on a boulder by the roadside and faced his mountain. That was the day the men of Marlborough and Dublin had set fire raging on Monadnock to drive out the wolves and bears that had been doing damage among the herds pastured on the slopes. Amos watched the fire climb slowly at first, starting from a dozen different places. Then, like a wall of destruction, it moved up the steep sides until the flames met and linked in a vast pyramid of fire at the summit, consuming everything that could be consumed and leaving the mountain bare and smoldering. Hate could do that to a man, Amos thought. Consume him and leave him smoldering. But he was a free man, and free at a great cost, and he would not put himself in bondage again. So Amos got up from the boulder and walked home, and his friend Moses walked with him, the Moses who had followed a pillar of cloud by day and of fire by night, and kept himself free from the bickerings of his people so he could be their leader. "You're late," said Violet, wondering at his silence. Amos agreed, then he told her of the fire on the mountain that he had been watching. "Did you bring back good money for your leather?" Violet asked. "It was paid for," Amos answered. Violet heard him putting the money away in the stone crock. She was surprised that it was going there, for that was a special fund Amos was creating. But she smiled to herself. So many coins must mean he had been paid well. Amos thought of all this as he sat in front of his house during the long summer twilights or watched the sun go down in glory behind his mountain. Amos told himself that if people knew what it was they did that caused suffering, they would no longer do it. As the days went on, he was aware of strength running from him gently like sap from a fallen tree. He felt heart hungry for heaven. Sometimes it was like a hurt within him. The longing was so intense. For years now, he had shared almost everything with Violet, but he could not tell her of the feeling that was growing within him, for he could not find the words to ease what would for her be pain. But he went on praying that he might know what it was he could do to help free the white man and bless his own people. Then one day, clear as the signs had always been in his life, he knew what it was. It was an October morning when the world stood crisp and clear in its first frostiness that Amos Fortune walked over the familiar road to the town to call on Deacon Spofford. In one hand, he carried a stout oak staff, and in the other, a leather bag into which he had emptied all the money in the stone crock. "Good morning, Amos, and how are you?" Deacon Spofford was a tall man, so they faced each other eye to eye, and though his manner was grave, his smile was the evidence of a warm heart. "Well, as I've been for a long while," Amos answered. He paused for a moment, then he went on. "But I'm thinking it's time to make my will." "Perhaps so," the deacon agreed. "But you're still strong and you've got a fine trade." Amos shook his head. "I've got a clear notion of what I want to do with my property. And I'm thinking when a man has that, it's a good time to make a will." "It is a good time. And it's you I want to execute it." Deacon Spofford looked across at the table at the dark face, strong of line and forceful, marked by kindness. He wondered what white man of comparable years had brought such renown to the town as had this tanner who lived so frugally and did his work so well. "I should be deeply honored, Amos Fortune," the deacon said as he reached his hand across the table to clasp the black man's hand. Between them, they drew up the will, Amos declaring himself to be weak in body, but of sound and perfect mind and memory, said that he wished to leave to Violet, his beloved wife, his household goods, all the improvements he had made on the land, and whatever profit there would be from his real estate, from the sale of his real estate. Deacon Spofford nodded. "That's a good farm of yours, Amos, and into it you've put heart as well as muscle. Whether Violet keeps it or sells it, it will care for her all her natural life. And here is my oath, my friend, that while I'm alive, no one shall take advantage of her." Amos smiled his pleasure at the deacon's words. Then he went on to make provision for Celindia, his adopted daughter. To her he left the furniture she was using, the loom and foot wheel, that she might always have a means of livelihood, and he commended her to Violet's care. "Have you any wish of your own that you would trust me to carry out?" Deacon Spofford asked. Amos nodded. "I'd like a handsome gravestone for myself and one for Violet when her time comes," he said quietly, "to be erected in my lot in the graveyard." "It shall be done," the deacon replied, "and William Farnsworth shall do it, for there is no man living among us now who can handle mallet and chisel better than he. What will you say on your gravestone?" Amos Fortune was silent for a moment, then he said, "I'd like Parson Ainsworth to write whatever goes on my stone and on Violet's too." Deacon Spofford made a notation of all that Amos Fortune had said. "There's one more request," the soft voice went on, lower than ever, since he had to say was so meaningful to him that he could speak it only with reverence. It was the answer to the prayer he had been praying all that summer. It was a designation of the fund that had been collecting in the stone crock. "Two things stand out in my life," Amos Fortune continued. "The way the mountain stands out in this country, church and school. I've got the money saved, and I'd like you to make a handsome present to each." He laid his leather bag on the table and drew out $100. "For the church," he said, "to purchase a silver communion service." "There are things the church has greater need of," Deacon Spofford reminded. The old man shook his head. He had said his vision, and he must see it through. For that holiest of moments that was shared by all alike, nothing could be too beautiful. And he knew, too, that nothing could give the church would carry further the whole meaning of his life. "Let it be done, as I say." Deacon Spofford wrote it down. "So be it," he said. "It shall be done." Amos unwrapped the handkerchief in which he had put the rest of the money from the stone crock, $243 in all. He counted it out slowly as he laid it on the table before Deacon Spofford. Among it was the money received from the town for the care of Polly Berdew, and some of the coins were those given to him at the tavern for the leather he had delivered there. Deacon Spofford noted that the amount and wrote after it, "For the school." Then, quill poised in hand, he looked across the table at Amos. "And will you say what should be done with it?" he asked. Amos answered, "The town shall use the money in any way it sees fit to educate its sons and daughters." "I have heard that those in your care have not always fared well at the school," Deacon Spofford said, as he was asking forgiveness of Amos Fortune. "That is why I give the money to the school," Amos replied as he rose to leave. There was nothing more to do but sign his name in the presence of three witnesses. This was done as Roger Gilmore, Jacob Baldwin, and Oliver Jewett were called in to subscribe their signatures. Amos Fortune walked slowly home, thinking of the disposition he had made of the last money he would ever earn. Humbly, he prayed that as the boys and girls learned more, they would know what they did, and so do only what was worthy of men and women. He was happy. He felt light of heart, and buoyancy came into his footsteps. "You can come any time now," he said, looking skyward, "for I am ready." In the churchyard in Jaffrey, New Hampshire, are two handsome headstones. The slate has withered well, and William Farnsworth's chiseling is clearly readable. They say, "Sacred to the memory of Amos Fortune, who was born free in Africa, a slave in America, he purchased liberty, professed Christianity, lived reputably, and died hopefully. November 17, 1801, age 91. Sacred to the memory of Violet, by sale the slave of Amos Fortune, by marriage his wife, by her fidelity his friend, and solace she died his widow, September 13, 1802, age 73. A silver communion service was purchased and was in use many years, and the fund designated for the school in Jaffrey is still in use.